going to commit the cardinal sin of turning down Tina Turner, but I have very good reason indeed, because my next guest actually wrote that song along with the best, Love is a Battlefield, Invincible, The Warrior. She's put it all down in a new book called I Am The Warrior, My Crazy Life, Writing the Hits and Rocking the MTV 80s. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the States, I think. It is the author and songwriter and performer, an absolute genius, Holly Knight. Holly, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you. See, I'm in Los Angeles, so it's morning here.
Well, very good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about, I'm always in awe of, A, as I said before, thank you for writing the soundtrack to my 80s life. But we hear so much about rocking in a man's world, because a lot of people you work with have been rockers, and you've really cut a swathe and made a stand for the women in music.
What's the question, though?
Well, how was it basically coming, you know, getting yourself heard and getting your voice heard in a man's world?
Oh, well, it was amazing. It still is, you know. I never sort of was consciously thinking I'm in a man's world. It's just that sometimes little flashes of things would come across and I would think, oh, but I didn't, it wasn't sort of like a mission from day one to just write about these things. They just happened naturally to me. I wrote about things that I knew and that I was feeling inside, and a lot of them just happened to be about fighting for the things that I believed in. And women resonated with that because I was doing it from a woman's perspective, you know.
When did you sort of realize, because lots of us wrote sort of tortured teenage ballads when we were in our teens, when did you actually sort of realize that actually, you know, people were saying, you know, you're really good, you should do something with this? How did it all start?
Well, I studied classical piano for 10 years, starting from age 4. So music was always my first language and continues to be. And I think I was just born with this, you know, gift that I had. And my mother very much was into music and wanted to play, but she was not very good at it. And every time she would get up from the piano, I would sit down and play what she was trying to play. So she realized that, gee, maybe she's the one with the talent in the family, and asked me if I wanted to have piano lessons. That started it. And then I discovered rock music. And of course, the louder, the better. And as I write in my book, there are many reasons that form any person, you know, the first 10 years of your life are your blueprint for the rest of your life. And I talk about that in the book. And just, you know, in the beginning, I wanted to be a rock star. It hadn't occurred to me that I was going to end up being a songwriter. That wasn't planned. That just sort of happened organically when I was in my first band, Spider.
So who were your, if you like, your influences? Who did you listen to as you were growing up? Who were the icons that shaped you musically and said, right, I want to be like that, or I want to develop that idea? Right.
Well, some of them were the obvious ones that everybody, I mean, you couldn't help it. They were everywhere. It was the Beatles. And of course, there was the Rolling Stones, which I sort of related more to them just because I thought there was something more glamorous about them. And I could relate to their lyrics more than I could to the Beatles. But I love them both. And then Led Zeppelin was a big influence, and the Doors. I really sort of leaned toward the darkness and the whole Jim Morrison thing. Led Zeppelin was the first really hard band, and that was very exciting as far as hard rock music. And then, I sort of had eclectic tastes too. I was into Frank Zappa, and I listened to Broadway music because I grew up in New York and we would go see plays and musicals. And then I became sort of a prog rock nerd for a while. And I was really into Emerson, Lake and Palmer because that was a keyboard player, you know, and I sort of fashioned myself in my mind into being the next female Keith Emerson, and I was into bands like that. And then, of course, there were all the bands from New York, sort of Bowie, but Iggy, you know, the whole CBGBs thing. I was into that as well. And eventually I left home very young. I was 15. And so by the time I went back to New York, I was 18 or 19. I know that's really young, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a parent. The thought if my kids had left at 15 is just horrifying. But It's all in the book as to why I didn't just wake up one day and leave. So I joined my first band and we got a record deal, and that's really what started the professional side of things. I also jumped on the stage at a Beach Boys concert when I was about 17 and ended up playing keyboards to Good Vibrations.
That must have been an interesting experience for everybody involved, I'm sure.
It was, because I looked out in the audience and I went, wow, this is very different. The view from up here is really different than the view from down there in the audience. I want to be a rock star.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You speak to people involved in music and they say being on stage, it is the ultimate buzz. You come off and you're absolutely, you're at a higher level, basically.
Well, because you're doing what you love, and yet you have people that are actually there to listen to you and adore you, and, you know, one hopes, not boo you off the stage, but it is the ultimate, because you're doing what you love anyway, but then you have an audience, and, you know, the energy that you exchange between the two of you is just amazing.
What was it like being in New York in that sort of that, because it's an interesting period. I'm a big lover of, you mentioned CBGBs. I'm a big lover of the stuff that came out from that time. Talking sure. Heads, Blondie, really exciting music. Yeah. And across the pond, Elvis Costello, Squeeze, all those acts. You mentioned Iggy, A Force of Nature. What was it like to be, because New York in the late 70s was dangerous, as opposed to now where it's all become a little bit more sanitized. So what was it like? How did you sort of get your in there? And what was it like sort of being around these people? And were you saying, oh, you know, here are some songs I've written, or were you pushing for Spider at that point?
Well, you're right. At that time period, and even in the early 80s, it was a very dangerous place. CBGB's now it's fashionable. And, you know, where CBGB's was is now a fashionable John Varvatos store. But back then it was in a really dark, there were crackheads lying on the sidewalk. And, you know, I talk about this in the book, actually. It's a good question you asked. It was a very seedy neighborhood. But that just added to the panache of the whole thing. I mean, sort of when I'm talking about that whole time period, I sort of refer to it in my book as the film noir period. And then when I moved to California, it was Fuji color and parties and just, you know. And I really became a songwriter because when I was in the band Spider, everybody was trying to have a go at writing songs. And I figured, well, their songs aren't the kind of songs that are going to get us on radio. So I might give it a go too and see what happens. And as it turned out, I was better at it than I thought. Because when we would do the records and we would turn the songs in, the label never knew who wrote what, and they would always pick my songs as the singles. So by the time I got to the second record, I ended up writing a song which later, a year later, became the second single on Tina Turner's Private Dancer record, which was Better Be Good to Me. So that was, and then there was John Waite from The Babies that was doing a solo record, and he recorded Change, another song that was on the second Spider record. So at that point, I had left the band for reasons I won't go into in this interview, but it's all in the book.
Yep.
And I'm shamelessly plugging my book.
Please shame. Listen, I'm in the area of greatness here. I'm just happy to hear you. You plug away. Just an interesting thing though, because Private Dancer, that is 84. It's Tina Turner absolutely staking her place. She'd been away for a while. Yes. She'd been in the wilderness music. And I remember because I was 16, 17 years old and MTV was out and it was like, bam. And Tina Turner is back with a, you know, Private Dancer, huge album, you know, the Better Be Good for Me, huge single as well. And she was again, I'm perhaps using the words of a different generation, but she was saying, I'm back. I'm empowering myself. And, you know, you go girl, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all know she was much more successful as a solo artist as she was with Ike. And, but that was like also very a classic time period for her. And she was ready at this point. She had left him. I mean, I think everybody knows the story by now. And run across the freeway into a hotel and asked for refuge and decided to sort of rebuild herself, recreate herself. I think a big part of her growth was becoming a Buddhist, which she talks about a lot. She chants every day. She heard the urban legend is she heard Better Be Good to Me in a playback meeting at the record company and jumped out of her seat and said, this is what I want to sing. It's rock and it's positive. So that's sort of what started our relationship. And over the years, she's recorded 9 of my songs. So she's basically, out of all the artists that I've worked for, she's my muse. And she even wrote the foreword to my book, which was just very flattering and wonderful that she did that.
And when you start things like Love is a Battlefield, which is a punchy, you know, brilliant rocker as well, and you see them, A, you get somebody else taking them on, and then, of course, we have MTV, and that was a whole new art form, and suddenly there are these ballsy, I mean, Pat Benatar's Love is a Battlefield is a fantastic video.
And you're doing a mashup, of Love is a Battlefield and Better Be Good to
Yeah,
Me.
Exactly. That could be the one. I can see it now. But yeah, I mean, it must have been quite a thrill as well to see these songs that you write put in on a video. I mean, because you have a mental image yourself of how they're going to be, and then a director has an image of how they're going to be.
Well, you know, my book is centric on MTV. It's very focused on that time period of 1980 to 1990, and then, you know, there's a lead up to that about my childhood, and there's an after, but it's really focused on that. And I was very lucky because I got all the original VJs. For people that don't know what that is, now that MTV is gone, they were video jocks. Now we have YouTube, and you just go right cut to the video. But there was Mark Goodman and Martha Quinn and Alan Hunter and Nina Blackwood, and they all wrote blurbs on the back of my book, and there's a chapter on MTV because it's the best thing that ever happened to me. I mean, I was very fortunate because I wrote for a lot of different artists, and by the time they came to me, that the record companies didn't want album tracks, they wanted singles. So of course the singles would be made into videos, and then MTV just happened to like the videos of the bands that I worked with, and they became a part of pop culture, and they became trendsetters at the same time. So this book is really a love letter to MTV and that whole time period, which unfortunately is sort of gone now. I mean, the M stood for music, and there's really, I don't even know if anybody goes to MTV anymore.
I remember because the importance that MTV had on making or breaking a band, when MTV Europe opened, yeah. What was it, 86, 87 maybe? We literally, as teenagers, we would sit around somebody who had MTV, and that was the Dagon, and we would take in the Dire Straits, the Peter Gabriels, the Phil Collins, the Aerosmith, the Bon Jovis. And this was the age of the big hair metal bands as well, wasn't it?
Right. Well, I had the single for Aerosmith, which was Ragdoll. I had Heart single, which was Never. I had Love is a Battlefield and Invincible for Pat Benatar. I had The Best. Well, that was a big one for Tina. Still is. And, you know, Better Be Good to Me was being played. And Animotion. I wrote a song called Obsession, which was really, really big.
Sorry, I didn't know you'd written that. That is one of my all-time favorites from that period. Yeah. Yes, you're my obsession. What do I have to do to make me sleep with me? That one, yeah, I remember that vividly. Oh wow, sorry, excuse me, Holly.
And then there was The Warrior, which was a huge video with Patti Smyth, and that's the title of my book. So that's just some of them. There were other ones, but those were some of the ones that stand out in my mind. And so they started doing blurbs on me or little news things every time they would do the news. Because in the beginning, they didn't have much content, which really was to my benefit. So they were talking about me like, oh, that was a song by songwriter Holly Knight, who also wrote this song. And then they would play another one. And it got to the point where actually, I wrote this in the book, I had to have a letter written by my attorney to MTV saying, I love all this attention. Please, if you could just turn it down a bit or mention the bands, because they're getting pissed off. Because sometimes I would write with them, or the bands didn't want people to know that somebody else wrote their songs, which has been the bane of my career, is that most songwriters really want people to think they wrote the song, and they'll actually go out of their way to perpetuate the myth. It's just part of what I do.
When you've had that series of huge hits, and I can't believe you wrote Obsession. I'm going to have to find that. You're just doing what comes naturally. There's no, did you feel any pressure? It's like when you record the first great album, then they say, okay, second album syndrome. Or did it just flow, and you were working with people, you were meeting Kiss, you were meeting Aerosmith, and you just thought, right, I've got the vibe now, here we go.
I think it was a bit of both. I think because I had done so well with the first one, as anybody in a band or an artist will tell you, then the need to sort of double up on that the second time, there's a certain amount of pressure, not only from yourself, but from the labels. Everybody's kind of looking at you to have the follow-up. And I tried to sort of put that in the back of my mind when I would be writing so that it wasn't coming from the wrong place. Because the minute you come from a place of, I have to write this da-da-da-da, as opposed to, I want to be a creative artist and I want to beat what I did before or whatever, it stops being real. Like the really good stuff that I write comes without that sort of premeditation of what I'm going to write. And I try to take artistic chances. Usually it's worked really well for me, and a few times it's backfired. So,
and what was the atmosphere like? Because it's MTV, the MTV Awards. As I said before, the Kiss, the Aerosmith, and somebody's just come in saying, "Wow, I have most of her songs on 12-inch vinyl." There you go, Holly. But what was it like?
I went to the first MTV show.
Yeah.
And Billy Idol was my date. Not a romantic day. We were pals, and we had met in the beginning because we both had the same manager, Bill Coyne. And, that's in the book too. And, we were both trying to make it in the beginning. I mean, he'd already had Generation X, but he'd come to sort of make a name for himself as a solo artist. So he was just at the beginning of that. And I was in Spider, but I hadn't become the songwriter yet. So when we saw each other a few years later, we pointed at each other and gave each other the high five, like, you did it. You know, he was on the cover of Rolling Stone, and he's like, and you did it too. And so I said, hey, let's go to the MTV Awards together. And we were both getting we were up for awards that night. So that was a lot of fun. And Kiss, I worked many times with Kiss. I'm probably the only, I would say, woman that's ever played keyboards on their record. And I played keyboards on the entire Kiss Unmasked record, which then years later that led to writing for them or with them. So that's why I say my crazy life writing the hits and rocking, it was a special time that I really cherish. And I thought that people would love to read about that stuff. I mean, my intent is for people that were growing up and they had that as the soundtrack to their lives, that they sort of get nostalgic and they laugh. Like, oh, I remember when I heard that song where I was. Or if you were too young or you weren't even born, my hope is that you want to read it anyway, because wish maybe that you had lived through that.
And then because the business has changed so much, and you look at writing credits now, and it's just like this huge list of people. I mean, what you were doing was perhaps more of a craft than songwriting by design or committee.
Yeah, I mean, there's different styles of writing, and I think for me, the true craft of songwriting involves actually writing music and lyrics from out of nowhere. But I do acknowledge that there are different art forms. I mean, there's a lot of sampling that goes on, and the people that sample them might, use many different samples in one song. And I've actually had songs sampled by rap artists and things like that.
And have they asked you beforehand, or you just went, hang on a second, I recognize
that? No, they have to license it. And that's why all the credits, because they don't want to get sued. So, yeah. You know, that's why they do that. But then there are other people that are, for instance, there'll be someone recording a song and someone will come in and deliver food for the artist. And it turns out he's friends with the producer and he makes a suggestion, or the producer says, well, what do you think of this? He makes a suggestion. All of a sudden his name's on the song as a songwriter. I think that's a bit unnecessary, So I try to write, these days I write a lot by myself, but I really like to write. I love the process of collaboration, but I'd rather write with just one person, maybe two at the most. And, if you need more than that, you shouldn't be calling yourself a songwriter, because anybody could walk in and have ideas.
My mind would probably not get past the drawing board, but absolutely. What was it like actually going up? Because we are talking, I mean, I had 80s hair. So
what was it?
Oh my God. Yeah, but I now have no hair, Holly, as opposed to yourself. So what was it like going back and remembering all that? Going back and remembering, and what if you had to pick out a highlight out of the many, what would it be?
You mean styles?
I mean, in terms of actual, was it the MTV Awards for Billy Idol, or was it working with Kiss, or was it writing for Aerosmith or Heart or any of that, or you know, helping Tina Turner get back to her rightful place at the top of her throne?
I think probably one of those would have been when I had to go to England. I hadn't met Tina Turner yet, but I had to go there to go over the key of a song, believe it or not, that I had written for her. That was in the Mad Max movie, the third sequel, sequel that she starred in. And while I was there, I was there now. I traveled 5,000 miles there and 5,000 miles back home. So that's like 10,000 miles. To go over the key of the song. But see, we didn't have digital stuff in those days. So sure. The reasoning was, if I had a little Walkman and I, her manager had suggested, why don't you just do 5 versions in 5 different keys and I'll give it to her. And I was like, well, that might not be very accurate because they run on batteries. And if the batteries are running at different speeds, it'll be the wrong key. So I ended up flying there. That's the short story of it. But you can read all of that in the book. So when I went there, she said, you have a few days before you have to go back. Do you want to come on tour with me? So I was like, sure. So I remember the first time I saw her live, I was sitting on a road case on the side of the stage. And then she launched into Better Begin to Me. And I looked at the audience and people were singing the words with her. They, they just knew all the songs. We were in Munich and they were German, but they knew all the English words. And it just dawned on me that this is what I was meant to do, to be a songwriter. And this is what I was going to continue to do. And she was at the peak, Private Dancer was out and she was amazing live. And I felt very privileged. Like, I'm actually in the music business. I'm not an amateur anymore. I'm a professional and I'm one of the tribe. So that was just beyond thrilling. It's still thrilling to me.
Absolutely. The book is called I Am the Warrior. Plug it again, Holly. I Am the Warrior, My Crazy Life.
I Am the Warrior.
Working the hits and rocking the MTV 80s. If people want to find you online, I believe you do both the Twitter and the Instagram thing.
Yes, I have Instagram, which is Holly Knight Vision. I have a website, hollyknight.com. I also have a link tree, which if you go to hollyknight.com, it'll take you to all sorts of places, lots of different places that I have. I have a YouTube channel. I have an Apple channel, all those things. And I just want to say that in addition to the book, the Audible book is out.
Are you dictating it?
The audio book. I'm narrating it. Yes. And not only that, there are never before heard demos of some of my biggest songs like Love is a Battlefield and The Best. And the exciting news is that on both Amazon and Audible, it's been listed as the number one hottest new release in popular music. So it's doing pretty good.
So not only are you have you been the number one songwriting artist, but now you're the number one hot thing in the world of publishing, Holly. There's no stopping you.
No, there isn't, and I'm just going to keep going. I have lots of other plans for other things to come out.
Well, please keep us informed. I'm absolutely, you do your little bit of research when you come on, and then you just drop that you wrote Obsession, and that's just completely blown my little tiny head, and I'll have to go away and slap myself with that one. The book is called I Am the Warrior, and I'll have to play that I've only got a few minutes left, but I'll definitely play it before we finish the show today. The book is called I Am the Warrior, My Crazy Life, Writing the Hits and Rocking the MTV 80s. Go and check out and do the I'm Not Worthy bit with Holly Knight, because she's been absolutely brilliant. Holly Knight, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, too. And I want to say, too, that I have been to Spain many times and absolutely love it. Love it.
Well, next time you're over, we'll have to try and meet up. Holly Knight, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Take care.